calling it as it is. You're with Hesher on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Privatizing police duties could save cities like NYC hundreds of millions to focus on crime, a new study says. So hundreds of millions of dollars by farming out quote-unquote non-core services to private outfits and have their officers focus almost exclusively on combating and preventing crime, a new study says. The enhancing public safety while saving public dollars with auxiliary private security agents analysis by the Montreal Economic Institute noted that the traffic control and minor accidents consume 13 to 19% of an officer's time. So Montreal wants to participate in the disingenuous mental masturbation routine of corporatizing law enforcement. Montreal, where do you get off? Going on here on the article, offloading 75% of traffic management duties to trained private agents, what are those, has the potential to save an enormous amount of time and money for police departments, they say. In addition, tasks such as escort duty, follow-up interviews with witnesses, preparing affidavits and warrants, and data collection could be handled by civilians. How does that strike everybody? Would you feel comfortable with corporate civilian citizens preparing your warrant and your affidavits and data collection? So this study estimates that $35.3 million in savings for the Miami-Dade Police Department in Florida. They say that this has a potential $22 million in savings for Milwaukee. And they said $177.4 million for the LAPD over a 15-year period. That doesn't actually sound like a very big savings to me, knowing what some of these police departments' budgets are, annual budgets. But folks, privatizing of police is a terrible idea. This plays into the hands of the defund the police talking point people, Democrats. The report talks about DUI checkpoints as though they'd be better policed by contractors, social workers, and state bureaucrat lackeys. I'm going to go ahead and say no thank you. We shouldn't be doing sobriety checkpoints in the first place. That's unconstitutional. And we certainly shouldn't be putting our safety and freedom in the hands of the lowest corporate bidder. Have you folks seen RoboCop? I bet some of you have. You know where this can go if you've seen RoboCop. Would you like Facebook to be running the law enforcement in the city of Austin or Santa Clara? How does that sound? To me, I've already been canceled by those people. So if they're running law enforcement, I got to assume they would put me in a real jail for saying things that I think. What do you think about Disney running law enforcement in Los Angeles? How's that sound, everybody? And Mickey Mouse and Goofy coming along with their goofy little badges, working on your affidavit, your arrest affidavit. Would this army of corporate thugs be trained properly? Would this army of corporate thugs hold an oath to the United States Constitution? Or would their oaths be to their ESG-loving corporate boardrooms? Don't miss out on a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. Available right now to download. Keeping you up to speed on TNT Radio.
At the risk of being canceled,
it's a battle for free speech against the left.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yeah, our next guest is a public policy analyst and a professor of finance at Stockton University in Galloway, New Jersey, where he teaches undergraduate and graduate courses in finance and economics. He's written op-ed columns in major newspapers for more than 35 years. He's been on the show here with me before, so if you're a regular, you heard he and I talking about finance and the housing crises and some other stuff last time we spoke. His name is Michael Bussler. Michael, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Well, thanks for having me, Brian. As you know, it's always my pleasure to be here.
Oh, I love having you too. I'm really happy you rejoined me today. So what do you think about privatizing police? Do you got any thoughts on that that news read there?
So generally, privatizing some government services usually works out fairly well. Now, some government services. And the reason is, so a lot of people say, look, it's cheaper if the government does it than if business does it. And the reason is government doesn't have to make a profit. So they just add up the costs and it'll have to make a profit. Business, on the other hand, has to make a profit. So it's going to be more expensive, they say, if business does it. The reality is it's just the opposite. Because business is motivated by profit, they try to produce things at the lowest possible cost that will allow them to still make a profit and charge a lower price when they're bidding against other contractors. Also, the government is not necessarily interested in efficiency. They just want to get the job done. Business, because they're motivated by profit, has to do everything very efficiently. So there have been many instances, trash collection in a lot of local municipalities, where privatization has helped. Now you're looking at police protection, though. That may be something different. The same logic with the Army. You know, you wouldn't want a private corporation providing the services that the Army does, you know, simply because with that kind of power, who knows what they'd be able to do. So you have to be very careful when you want to privatize services. Generally, it makes sense in many areas. It may not make sense in every area.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, it'd be one thing if we hadn't experienced 2020 the way we did and they hadn't made such a giant meal out of defunding the police and telling the American population that all police are racists. I mean, gosh, it's like 35% of the LAPD, I think, is Latino, and there's another large contingent that is Asian. So, you know, a lot of these arguments just fall flat. And then we saw the way that some of the local governments, like governors and mayors, responded to things like in Seattle, for example, during the George Floyd incident. They actually just like, you know, and then the entire year of Antifa activities, more than a year of Antifa activities in Portland and other places, you know, people burning down buildings, people annexing entire blocks from the city. Police abandoning police outposts, you know, department offices in Seattle, all kind of just bolstering this whole concept that all cops are bad and that the policing system is systemically racist, like which system isn't to these people. But, you know, it'd be one thing if like we saw those entities, those city councils, those governors, those mayors and the media operatives and the politicians, you know, acknowledging that, hey, there's something wrong here, acknowledging they have a problem with crime, maybe acknowledging too much resource going into procedural stuff that's not, you know, tactical or whatever. But it's not that way. We're not seeing it that way. We're seeing them literally trying to kind of chip away at this institution and turn the people against it. So to me, this whole report and this whole concept, like, it can't really fly considering that they've kind of showed their hand on their agenda here.
Yeah. If I can just add, you know what really the big, oh, if we look at the big picture here, what the problem is, Americans have lost faith in government. And doesn't matter what party you're in, you've lost faith in government because their government is not telling us the truth. And we don't know exactly what to believe. It's very important. I understand the reality of politics. No matter what happens, you have to at least spin it so it looks like it's in your favor. I understand spinning, but there's a difference between spinning and outright lying. And there's been so much of that done that people have just lost faith in government. And when government says something, they really don't know, well, is this true or if it's not true? For a democracy to thrive and continue, we have to have faith in our elected officials. The other thing that is really missing here that's hurting democracy, democracy needs healthy debate. We're all not going to agree. We're going to have different ideas. We should be free to express those ideas and free to debate those ideas. In order to come up with optimum solutions that benefit the majority of the people, and that's what the goal should be, the best solution that benefits the majority of the people without infringing upon the basic rights of anyone, that should be the goal. And in order to reach that, we need healthy debate. where people are not afraid to say, listen, I look at it this way. I understand you look at it that way. I don't think that's quite in line with how things should be. We need to return to that. Otherwise, I'm afraid of where things are going to go. This idea that everything that passes Congress, it's almost 100% from one party and zero from the other. That's not the way things are supposed to work. That's why with the Senate, they said it takes 60 votes to have something passed, because they knew 99% of the time, one party is not going to have 60 senators. So in order for laws to become law, at least some members of the other party are going to have to join in. That means there's some compromise. There's some understanding of what the other side is saying, and there's some way to filter everything in to come up with a solution that may not be everything you wanted, but it gets you pretty close to what you wanted, and it allows enough of the people that have a different view to go along with it. That's really what we need in this country, bigger than the debate we're talking about, just privatization.
Yeah, the ability to actually voice our opinions. My goodness, that's core American right there, my friend.
Extremely important. We have to feel free. And I'll tell you, I teach at a university that was started as a liberal arts college 50 years ago. So they still have a very liberal faculty. There's 332, I think, faculty members. I found maybe three or four that share my views. And when some subjects come up for debate and I'm in a large setting with my faculty members, I can't say what I really feel. If I do, I'll get all kinds of scorn and they won't listen to me. And they say, oh, you're just another one of those Trump nut people. So it's very difficult. I have to be very tactful with the way I say things. And I know if a confrontation, I remember in 2010 when we were doing the whether Obamacare was a good idea or not, everybody in the college said it was a great idea. I tried to give some opposing view, and I tell you, I felt a lot of scorn. Now, since that, in the 10, 12 years since that, things have gotten significantly worse, not better.
Yeah, they really have. I used to work in a university environment too, and luckily for me, it was a military environment. So there were actually a large contingent of independents, libertarians, conservatives.
Yeah,
but there were also a lot of liberal-minded professors there, even in our military institutions. I'm talking about the Navy School in Monterey, California, and but I liked that. I enjoyed that. A more balanced thing. Like I detest the dialectics that those two sides, put out as the arguing points in many cases, because I feel like there's no room for nuance and there's no room for anyone that's outside of the two political identities. But at the same time, at least we could have those discussions. I had two bosses. I worked two projects, and one of my bosses was a classic liberal, and the other one was a classic conservative. And I was not very politically in tune at the time. And I'd love sitting down and listening to those two military veterans talk to each other, because they had completely different viewpoints. They would argue, but they were best friends. You know what I mean? They were really tight. And I think it makes me sad that that's not the case, at all the universities, because that would make things a lot better, I think.
Brian, it certainly would. And what upsets me the most is I think that faculty members are doing a tremendous disservice to the students. Most of the liberal professors only present one side of an argument. So when I see these students, they only hear one side. They just say the other side is wrong. I teach a course occasionally in ethics. I teach it from a business standpoint. I try to present both sides of the argument, and I say, look, the reason you're here, I mean, you're learning certain specific things you need, I understand that, but the primary reason you're here is to learn critical thinking skills. So what that means is listen to what this guy says, listen to what the other guy says, and then you decide which makes the most sense. And if you can follow that into your politics and into your voting, that's great. I often start the class off with How many people were in favor of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour? And, you know, almost all the class says, yeah, it's a thing we should do. And I said, well, why should we do that? And they give their reasons how people can't live on less than $15 an hour. And why should somebody work 40 hours and all these people are rich and the people that are barely getting by? And I said, okay, so that's one argument. Now, does anybody not favor it? And there was very few, if any. I said, well, here's the argument for not raising the minimum wage. You set the wage above it, what the equilibrium would be, end up with unemployment. And I know there's a labor shortage today, but up until the labor shortage today, the unemployment rate for teenagers was always three times what the national average is. The unemployment rate for, to look at a category, women entering the workforce for the first time, always two or three times what the national average is. So just the people you're trying to help, you end up hurting because there's no job available for them. Isn't it better off to have everybody working at $12 an hour rather than having 80% of the people working at 15 and the other 20% can't get a job? Well, I look at my students and I see them sort of scratching their head a little bit, saying, well, maybe that makes a little bit of sense. So I said, look, you've heard both sides of this. You figure out which makes the most sense. And when it comes time to vote for a candidate who supports one position or another, have your voice there and vote for that candidate. You've got to learn these critical thinking skills. You'll never get through life, or it'll be much more difficult to get through life if you can't figure things out. So that's what we should be teaching. Here's both sides. You figure it out.
Right, right. Yeah, I love it. You know, that's a big problem. And that's what higher education is for. That's what all education exactly should be for, is to build and then build upon and then enhance our critical exactly thinking skills, our logic skills. And it sure doesn't help to have a mass media out there that's funded by big government, big pharma, and all this other stuff, like telling us what to think about the issues instead of giving us the issues and both sides of the issue there. I got to take a quick station break, but we'll be right back, everybody, with Professor Michael Bussler here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio's Patrick Henningsen.
So the question they're posing to this doctor, it feels like the viruses are all over the news, whether it's monkeypox, Ebola, polio, or coronavirus. And Dr. Varma answers here, several factors help explain why we're hearing so much about viral outbreaks. The key operative word there is hearing so much. We're hearing so much. The reason we're hearing so much about viruses is because the media can't stop pumping it out. Are there more viruses out in nature? Is there an explosion of different viruses? No. You'd have to be really debilitated on an intellectual level to sort of posit anything like that.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of hosts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
Democracy in action. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back, everybody. I'm joined by Professor Michael Bussler. He teaches at Stockton University in Galloway, New Jersey. He teaches graduate courses in finance and economics. And if you're just joining us, you can, of course, find the beginning of the interview and the whole show at tntradio.live in the episodes area. That's where you go. If you want to share this around, I highly suggest you do share this around. We're talking about critical thinking. We're talking about the education system. We're talking about the dialectics, just the nasty, divisive dialectics and the media's unfortunate agenda to tell us what to think about dialectical talking points rather than just giving us the facts. Just, you know, that's one of my biggest problems with the mass media cartel. You know, it's, I'm sick of it. I'm sick of seeing the divisive nature, and I'm sick of, we're now, I guess we must be multiple generations into this sort of paradigm now, because as you've pointed out in the school that you work at, there's only a couple of people like yourself who are outside of that, you know, here's what the political news is and here's how to think about it and here's what, how to vote. You know, I mean, that's been very detrimental to our country, I think. And, you know, the blame sort of goes to the politicians, the Fortune 100, the mass media cartel itself, and the education system. You know, quite frankly, the education system is probably one of the long poles in the tent when it comes to making the population really sort of just, you know, malleable to this sort of psychological, constant 24/7 psychological operation of, here's today's crisis. If you're watching CNN, here's how you look at it. If you're watching Fox, here's how you look at it. Don't paint outside the lines and just make sure to, you know, keep your muzzle pointed downrange at the other side. It's just such a big distraction for everybody, and it's really primed the public to, you know, respond to the fear stimuli that they get from the media or in school. You know, there is a fear stimuli, I think, that comes with being told that, you know, your country is systemically racist and, you know, your conservative teacher is a Nazi or whatever. You know, I mean, it's just insane the labels they put on everything. But I mean, that bugged me, as it bugs me as someone who worked in academia, and clearly it bothers you too, but you have a proactive approach with it by trying to get through to your students. So, you know, I really appreciate the way that you approach that.
Yeah. And sometimes it's, as I mentioned, a little difficult to get through to the students because they've only heard one point of view, and they've been sort of indoctrinated into that point of view. But if you give them both sides and tell them to think about it, they will end up doing that. You know, while we're talking a little bit about higher education, I don't know if you heard this morning, the Congressional Budget Office calculated how much it would cost to have President Biden forgive $10,000 worth of student loans for virtually every American, at least making under $125,000. The cost was over, now Biden said it was going to be a little over $200 billion. Turns out it's a little over $400 billion. So it's twice what he said. You know, and this whole program seems very ridiculous to me. First, they say, well, there's a lot of people there that can't afford to get on with their life because this heavy student burden that they have. So we're going to help them. We're going to forgive $10,000 of it for everybody making $125,000 a year or less. Most of the people are averaging about $75,000 a year. We're going to make their life better by forgiving $10,000 of their student loans. Now let's take a look at how much better this is going to help their lives. So when you have a student loan, I looked this up yesterday, the average rate on student loans is 5.8%, and you get up to 10 years to pay this back. So $10,000 at 5.8% for 10 years turns out to a monthly payment of $110 a month. Now you tell me somebody making $75,000 a year, it's over $6,000 a month, or $125,000, that's over $10,000 a month. How $110 a month is going to change the life of somebody making between $6,000 and $10,000 a month? It's simply not going to happen. So it's going to have minimal effect. It's going to cost taxpayers, and 62% of households did not go to college. Only 38% did. So now all of college has households have to pay it back. And what about guys like me? You know, I paid $1,800 a month for 10 years to pay off all the student loans. I had some, I consolidated when my kids went to college. Why didn't they do this sooner? And then the real danger is the people in college today are going to say, well, if you forgave 10,000 of the people that graduated, you're going to have to do that for me too, right? So I'm going to expect 10,000. How about the people in high school? Well, I'm just about to go to college, but am I going to get the $10,000 debt relief that everybody else got? What I'm afraid this leads to is the government funding higher education and the government taking over higher education. When that happens, the quality will go down. The price, which is already way, way out of line, admittedly, but it'll get worse with government control. And the worst part is Americans are going to lose some freedom, because when the government controls a market, they decide who does what. My wife is Canadian. She's from Montreal. In Quebec, the government, province of Quebec, the government controls the education system. They decide who goes on to what they call CJEP or goes on to college or not. So government control things, we're going to lose individual freedom. What really upsets me about everything that the Biden administration has done in the last year and a half, year and three quarters now, it goes against the principles that really made this country what it is today. Now, why do I say that? So the U.S. went from, I'm a trained economist, so I look at economics. The U.S. went from the birth of a nation to the largest, most prosperous economy in the world in about 150 years. Other countries were hundreds, in some cases, thousands of years older. How did that happen? In my view, there were four basic principles we followed. One, we encouraged individual freedom. As long as you didn't infringe upon anybody else's rights, you pretty much do what you wanted to do. Secondly, we encouraged individual responsibility. As long as you were mentally and physically able to take care of yourself, everybody, usually with their family, everybody pretty much took care of themselves. Thirdly, we had very low rates of taxation. So whatever you earned, you knew you were going to keep most of it. That's a plenty. It's a big incentive for people to start earning. And fourthly, we had a very limited role for government. They provided certain public goods like defense of the country, a legal system. But other than that, they stayed out of the way. So individual freedom, individual responsibility, low rates of taxation, and a limited role for government, I believe, are what allowed the country to do so well in such a short period of time. Now, look at what everything the Biden administration's doing. It's against all four of those principles. They want to limit, they want to take over the healthcare market. They want to take over the higher education market. Once they take over a market, they decide who goes where. You're going to lose individual freedom. Secondly, they're trying to replace individual responsibility with social responsibility. Don't worry, the government will take care of you. We'll take care of your health care. We'll take care of your child care. We'll make sure there's adequate amount of food stamps. We'll make sure everybody. So the government wants to replace people taking care of themselves, individual freedom, with individual responsibility, rather, with social responsibility. Thirdly, in order to pay for all this, you're going to have to raise taxes on everybody. Well, we'll only raise taxes on the wealthy. Well, there's not that many wealthy people to raise enough money to cover everything the Biden administration wants to do. And eventually, everybody gets higher rates of taxation. And fourthly, instead of a limited role for government, the government's controlling as much as they can. So everything the Biden administration does is against the four principles that, in my view, are allowed the country to prosper in such a short period of time. That's why I'm so opposed to almost everything the Biden administration has suggested.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about privatizing things at the beginning there. Now we're talking about federalizing things, and we're talking about big things here. And I love how you point that out. You know, we did something amazing in this country in 100 years with freedom, responsibility, low taxes, and limited government. That's what got us into the Industrial Revolution. That's what moved us to the Technological Revolution. But unfortunately, somewhere between those two, we started getting into globalizing things, which is the next level up, worse than federalizing things, right? And a lot of these federalizing programs really are aimed at more of a global citizen sort of viewpoint. So it's like we've crossed the Rubicon here of like the terrible effects of federalizing things, and now they want to do more of that. Tell us, you know, piss on us, tell us it's raining and it's going to be wonderful because there's a drought. while they hand off, you know, our complete, like, everything about America. You know, I say this often, if they're going to complete their sustainable Agenda 2030, if they're going to make us live with Agenda 21 forever, and if they're going to give the WHO the ability to tell us that, you know, our sovereignty is contingent on their PCR tests, we're screwed. We've lost it. We are no longer that country that did that amazing feat in 100 years if we allow that to happen.
That's exactly right. And I'm hoping the election we're having in about 40 days, I think the country, it's a little hard to read this because the press put some things out there that I'm not quite sure is accurate. A lot of the polling, when I looked at a lot of the polling and I looked at their samples are weighted in favor of Democrats. So when you end up seeing these results, some of these polls, I scratched my head and I said, people really think like that. And I think a lot of it has to do with these polls that are being slanted. So we need this accurate information, which we're not getting. We need to restore the faith back in the government. We need to go back to the principles that made the country great. I think the American public, and it's a little hard to tell, but the way I see it, I think the American public is just getting fed up with all this, telling us what to do, trying to completely control our lives, keep raising our taxes, keep telling us what we should buy and what we shouldn't buy. We have to live now with violent crime in virtually every major city. I think Americans are fed up with this. And regardless of how the polls may and the newspaper, the presses may spin this, I think people are really going to be fed up. And I think both houses of Congress are going to flip to the Republican side. And then Republicans can really stop the Biden agenda that I think is really ruining the country. I mean, take a look. He's been in office not even 2 years, and we went from we're coming out of a pandemic, but we had a V-shaped recovery. It was a thriving recovery. We're operating at a 6% growth rate, and now we're in a position, we're actually in a recession. Regardless of what the government says, we're in a recession. Even if you don't admit we're in a recession, the facts say we haven't had any economic growth since the end of 2021. Both the first quarter and the second quarter of this year had negative growth. So you took an economy that was growing at a 6% rate and turned it negative. How somebody could do that in such a short period of time, it really amazed me. And now that we're in such a bind here, what we have to go through to fix it is going to be relatively painful. You know, I used to have a lot of faith in the Federal Reserve. Since 1980, they've always monitored the money supply to make sure we never had an inflation problem. And for 40 years, we didn't have an inflation problem. Last year, the Federal Reserve had what I call shockingly irresponsible monetary policy. Now, why do I say that? The Federal Reserve is supposed to be ahead of problems. And one of their goals is price stability, keeping inflation low. In the last 40 years, if there's even a hint of inflation, they reduce the rate of growth of the money supply, they raise interest rates a little bit, gets some demand out of the economy and keeps inflation where it should be. Last year, the consumer price index prior to the pandemic usually goes up about 0.1% or 0.2% every month. So if you multiply that by 12, it's about a 2% annual inflation rate. That's what we've been saying. January of 2021, the consumer price index went up 0.3%, went up 0.4% in February, 0.6% in March, 0.8% in April. Clearly, we had an inflationary problem building. The Federal Reserve at that time should have reduced the rate of growth of the money supply by stop buying $120 billion a month of government bonds that they were buying. And they should have started to gradually raise interest rates. Had they done that in March of 2021, quarter of a point, another couple months later, quarter of a point, another couple months later, quarter of a point, just like they did between the end of 2016 and the end of 2018. Had they done that, this inflation problem would be about a half of what it is. Instead, They said, oh, don't worry, the inflation problem is temporary. They used the word transitory. Never in history, except maybe during a war or something, never in history have we had temporary inflation. You can have a price spike in a certain market and the market corrects, that's true. But inflation has never been temporary. They did nothing all through 2021, left interest rates near zero. They kept buying $120 billion a month of government securities. It wasn't until March of 2022, they finally ended the bond buying program and finally said, well, you know, I guess we do have to raise interest rates. So it went up a quarter of a point. It did nothing. And they met again in May. Well, maybe a little more. We'll go up half a point. It did nothing. They said, now we have a serious problem. We have to get rid of inflation. The only way to get rid of it now that we're so far behind the curve is to raise interest rates 0.75 point in June, 0.75 point in July. They didn't meet in August, 0.75 point in September. And they're going to have to do it at least 0.75 point, at least two more times before the end of this year. And even the Federal Reserve admits that's going to cause some pain to the American public. And it's pain we didn't have to have. If they were more responsible last year and started to gradually raise the interest rates, we wouldn't be in the position that we're in today. That's one of the reasons that adds to the public losing faith in the federal government.
Yeah, you know, because they're doing this in the name of COVID, which is a really dodgy story with dodgy people. They're doing it in the name of Ukraine, another dodgy story with dodgy people. And they're doing it in the name of climate change, another dodgy story with dodgy people. And all three of those topics, if you don't, if you go against the mainstream narrative on them, you'll be censored, you'll be shadow banned, you'll be deplatformed, demonetized. They don't want us pointing out that the reasons that the mass media is giving us for these things are all dodgy. So it strikes me that what you just laid out there, and thank you for that, that was really informative and helps me understand some things about the Fed that I don't really understand, you know, typically. But what you just said right there, Michael, I think is pretty amazing, because we're all wondering right now what's going to happen in Europe. What, like, they've, you know, they've basically been forced or have chosen to commit economic suicide, at least in the energy department, over all of this. And the Federal Reserve, I mean, clearly with what you just laid out, they have the tactics. They know how to stop this sort of, you know, runaway stagflation leading to a recession. Is this, you know what I mean? I don't think this is an oops. It doesn't seem like something that smart people over there would say, oops, we didn't do that right. Do you think this could possibly be about creating a wartime economy without actually starting a war? I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. So you bring up a great point, Brian. So is this politically motivated? So the Federal Reserve is supposed to be independent of politics. They're just supposed to reach the economic goals. Why the Federal Reserve did what they did last year, I don't know. Look, you have very intelligent people like Janet Yellen. Is a very intelligent lady. She's got an Ivy League PhD. She's a full professor at Cal Berkeley. She was chair of the Federal Reserve herself. She's now Secretary of the Treasury. Extremely intelligent lady. Why she was saying in the early 2021, don't worry, the inflation is going to go away. She knew that wasn't the truth. If you end up having massive deficits in the federal government's budget, and in the last three fiscal years, 20, 21, and 22, which gets over at the end of the month, the federal government has spent nearly $7 trillion more than they brought in tax revenue. On a $23 trillion economy, that's pure excess demand, which is pure inflation. If you have a policy that says we need to have the U.S. use less fossil fuels, so we're going to restrict the supply of fossil fuels by canceling the Keystone Pipeline. You can't drill on federal lands anymore. Can't drill in the Anwar province in Alaska. No more fracking off the coast of Alaska. The permitting process is more difficult. All those things they did restricted the supply of fossil fuels. And when you restrict the supply of anything, the price goes up. So we had inflation even before you blamed it on Putin or Europe, whoever you blamed it on. We already had energy inflation. So knowing that we had energy inflation, knowing that we had the huge government spending deficits, knowing that the Federal Reserve keeps pumping money into the economy and keeping interest rates near zero, and fourthly, knowing that you're paying people not to work. I know people that got laid off during COVID. They got unemployment compensation. The government added money to it. I saw a study that said two-thirds of the unemployed people are making more money not working than working. You're paying people not to work. In order for business to get them to come back to work, they've had to offer higher wages. You say, well, that's good for the workers. Yeah, it's good for the workers. It's terrible for business because their labor costs keep going up and their energy costs keep going up. So you look at the energy inflation, wage inflation, excess government spending, and the shockingly irresponsible monetary policy, any economist will tell you that is going to lead to pure inflation. How they came up with what they did, was it politically motivated? I know Janet Yellen thinks climate change is the most important thing, so maybe that clouded her judgment. Jerome Powell wanted to get reappointed in November, so maybe he wanted to accommodate the president, and maybe that clouded his judgment. But you get a guy like Larry Summers, who's a very progressive economist. He was, I believe, Secretary of Treasury in the Bill Clinton administration. He was an advisor to Obama. He was president of Harvard. So he's very progressive-oriented. Even he said to his own party, you're going to have a very serious inflation problem if you keep up with what you're doing. And they ignored him, too. So they did nothing all through 2021. Finally, we're into 2022. You realize we have a problem. Now you have to take drastic action. I think it's too late. I think they're going to have to jack interest rates up way like they did in 1981. They had to take interest rates way up to solve the inflation problem. That brought on a very severe recession. And I think we're already in a recession, but I think it's going to get worse as we go on here. Because the Federal Reserve is going to have to continue to get those interest rates up, and that's going to lead to a more severe recession. Brian, you also used a word that is not used that much, stagflation. So stagflation is when you have a stagnant economy, even if you say we're not in a recession. It's not growing, so you have to admit it's stagnant with high inflation. That's the worst possible economic condition, because to solve the slow growth, you have to stimulate the economy. To get rid of the inflation, you have to do exactly the opposite. So it turns out to be a very difficult problem to solve. A little bit of history. In 1980-81, Paul Volcker was chairperson of the Federal Reserve. He said, look, all throughout the 70s, we didn't do anything about inflation, and it's way out of control. It's up to 10%. He pushed interest rates up to double-digit levels. For those of us that are old enough to remember, the mortgage rates were up in the 16-18% range. It did take all the demand out of the economy, so inflation came way down. That's true, but it caused a very severe recession that it took more government action, particularly with taxes, to get out of. So what I'm afraid of here is that the interest rates get pushed up so high that it takes out too much demand in the economy, and we end up with a severe recession before the inflation rate comes down. And this stagflation is the worst possible economic condition.
Oh boy, I don't like the sound of that. Let's pick up right there after we'll do one more break with TNT here. We'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about stagflation, see if maybe we can come up with some solutions or at least some situational awareness for everybody, because I think that's important. Okay. We'll try to end the show on an upbeat here, because is all pretty scary, isn't it?
Okay.
Yes. All right. Okay. We're going to take a quick break, everybody. You are listening to today's News Talk.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
In a stunning repudiation of both the European Commission and its ham-handed president, Ursula von der Leyen, Italian Sunday said affangul to globalism, sweeping Giorgia Meloni's Fratelli d'Italia, our Brothers of Italy party, to first place in the election and in position to control the new Italian government. Von der Leyen, who goes by the moniker VDL in accordance with the now familiar globalist style sheet, had essentially threatened Italians last week, saying, "We have ways of making your vote correctly," in reply to a reporter asking whether she had any concerns about the then upcoming Italian election. Her actual words are more darkly troubling. Alluding to Nationalist Party elections in Hungary, Poland, and now Sweden, von der Leyen remarked that, quote, "democracy is not safe," end quote, from nationalists, and, quote, "we have tools," ostensibly to deal with those who will not comply with globalist efforts to impose their hegemony on EU member states. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
My therapist had told me that I needed to go to AA meetings, but I wasn't sure whether I wanted to go because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. That was not what I wanted to grow up and be. I didn't want to go to AA, but I did, and it wasn't what I expected by any means. It was friendly. I could feel it. I mean, I could feel the happiness. It's really great.
Visit AA.org for more information and download the Meeting Guide app to find a meeting near you.
Government today.
They're not human. They ought to be destroyed.
It's like all the children from the Village of the Damned grew up and went into politics.
You can't stop us, you know.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
It do be like that sometimes, don't it? All right. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. I'm joined by Professor Michael Bussler. And we're talking about the financial situation in the United States right now. We've talked about federalizing things, privatizing things. We've talked about inflation, talked about the Federal Reserve, loan forgiveness, that whole thing. What a mess. We got midterm elections coming up. We're all wondering, are the polls accurate? Is there a red wave inbound? Is there another vote steal inbound? Some people are asking. I don't know. But our guest has laid out the situation very well here. We're talking about the Federal Reserve. We're talking about the government and the ways in which the government are paying people not to work, paying people not to grow food, paying people to promote COVID fear, leading to printing even more money, paying hospitals to do things that were not normal just 18 months ago. Paying for the war in Ukraine, paying media to scare everybody about the climate, which we will have to pay to fix, right? So pain and austerity over COVID, over Ukraine, over climate change. Is it too late? What happens when they print more money, more money, more money? The government is just like a rap music video. They just slinging dollar bills at us all the time, except they don't land in my pocket. I got $1,200 from Trump. But that disappeared real quick in the situation here. So is it too late? Well, maybe it is. We're definitely in a stagflation. We're definitely going to a wartime economy, which might actually be the war, is just the economic warfare, at least for those of us in the West, you know, in Western Europe and in the United States. So where do we go from here, Michael? How do we solve this, and what can our listeners do to take heart, to protect themselves? Any suggestions on the upshot here?
Okay, so here's what I think is likely to happen. So the Federal Reserve will keep pushing interest rates up. Eventually, the inflation rate will start to come down. Now, that might not be until sometime early to the mid next year. In the meantime, to get all that inflation rate down, the recession will continue into next year. Now, the question is, how do we get out of this? How do we fix this? So, again, take a look back in history. So, 1981, we had the same problem. High inflation, recession came on, we had stagflation. How did we get out of it? So, by 1984, the economy, inflation was down under 4%. The economy grew in 1984 to 7.5% annual rate. How did that happen, and how does that apply now? So right before the break, we're talking about the problem with stagflation is if the government stimulates demand to get growth, it makes inflation worse. If you reduce demand to get inflation down, it makes growth go down. So how do you fix it? Economists said you can't look at just demand. You've got to look at the supply side of the equation. So in 1982, supply side economics was essentially established. And what did they do to bring us out of it? They said, look, if you've got high prices and low output, demand can't fix that. But if you increase the supply, you're going to get output to go up. And if you increase the supply, you put downward pressure on prices. How do we do that? So with supply side economics, we have tax cuts for everybody. So you have more to spend, and also for business. So they have enough capital to expand to meet the demand. We also cut taxes for the highest income earners. They say, well, there's a tax cut for the wealthy. It's another trick again. No, when you cut taxes for the wealthy, what that ends up doing, it doesn't affect their spending. They're still going to spend the same for their lavish lifestyles, but it increases their amount of savings, which creates more capital. And when you have a capital intensive economy and there's plenty of capital available, business can grow. Secondly, we said we want to make it easier for business to grow. Instead of putting on all these regulations that have been put on, we're going to reduce the number of regulations. Look, the Trump administration did something very similar to this. We're going to get rid of every, what is it, two or three regulations for every new one that we put in. We reduced regulations. In 2018, Congress passed a supply side tax cut, and the economy didn't grow quite as much as we'd like it to, but the economy did grow. Unemployment came down to record levels. And in 2020, the inflation rate was down to 1.5%. So what's going to happen, I think, if the Republicans get control of Congress, they'll propose some legislation that will tend to increase aggregate supply. Now, will that end up becoming law? The president has to sign it. If he says, no, this is against climate change, and it makes income inequality worse, and there's more social injustices, this is going to worsen, he may not sign it, and we can't override the veto. So we may run into a period for a couple of years where we have gridlock. And gridlock means Congress passes something and the president won't sign it. Now, I don't know if that'll happen. I don't know if the president will be forced to sign legislation. But what we need to do to get out of this is bring freedom back to the market, reduce the regulations, keep income taxes low. And as Ronald Reagan said in 1984, if you're thinking about doing anything, his exact words were, go for it. Go for it. So give Americans that spirit again that, hey, if you want to try something, go ahead and do it. We've set the economy up. So interest rates are now at a reasonable point. Your taxes have been cut. So you have income. We reduced regulations. So it should make it easier for you. Take a chance. If you ever wanted to do something, now's the time to do it. And in 1984, the economy grew at a 7.5% annual rate, and inflation was relatively low. So that's the kind of things we're going to need going into the future to get out of this terrible stagflation problem that we're in. And although inflation took a pause in July and August of this year, consumer price index barely went up at all, that's going to change in the fall. Energy prices are again going to start to go up. A lot of it has to do with geopolitical forces. And the real one that's going to hurt, food prices are about to skyrocket. Real quick, why is that? American farmers tell me they're going to have to charge significantly more for their crops this fall because they're paying twice what they used to pay, in some cases 2.5 times what they used to pay for fertilizer. And they need a lot of fertilizer to grow. Secondly, they can't get people to come to work. So what do they have to do? Raise wages. Well, that just increased their labor costs. And thirdly, you tell me, look, gasoline's down under $4 a gallon, $3.50 a gallon. That's great. I use diesel fuel in all of my equipment. I'm paying close to $6 a gallon for diesel fuel. All of those costs mean if I can't get a better price for my harvest, it doesn't pay me to grow anymore. So food prices are going to go up in America. Worldwide, it's going to be worse because about 25% of the world's wheat supply and 10% of some other grains are grown in Russia and the Ukraine, and we're not going to be able to get all that out. Food prices are going to go up. We're going to have a return to inflation. Federal Reserve is going to get more aggressive, and we'll see what happens going forward.
All right. Well, it's going to be interesting. I think you and I are going to have to stay in touch as these situations develop.
Will.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay. You want to give any shout outs, any books or anywhere you want to point listeners to where they can?
Yeah. So if anybody wants to see what I've been writing, I write for a Newsmax and Town Hall Hill, a couple other ones. But if you just look on my Twitter, I tweet out every one of my columns. It's at M Bussler. That's at M Bussler. And if you have a Facebook page, search for Funding Democracy. Funding Democracy. All of my columns are there, and I'd be happy if anybody followed.
All right. Thank you, Professor Bussler. I look forward to your next visit.
Thank you, Brian. It was my pleasure. Look forward to doing it again.
Oh, the pleasure's all ours over here at TNT. Thank you so much. That's Professor Bussler, everybody. What an amazing conversation. You know, the situation seems dark sometimes out there, but hey, when we can put it in context, when we can understand it better, the darkness, it lifts real quick, no matter what the outcome is. So big thanks to Professor Bussler here. We'll look forward to seeing him again on the Brian McLean Show. And with that, we're going to take a break. We're going to go to top of the hour, and we will be back at you on TNT real soon here.